In January of 2017, and I arrived in South Sudan. It was in the midst of a civil war between the opposition forces that were underneath Dr. Riek Machar and the government forces under President Salva Kiir. And over the course of the next few months, probably close to 1 million people fled out of South Sudan into Uganda and Sudan in particular, but right around the region. A lot of people fled their homes, became displaced because and there was a lot of violence, homes being burned, people killed, women, a lot of sexual assaults on women and rapes. So it was a pretty dire situation. And during the course of that year, slowly but surely, the international community and the UN was part of that effort, were pushing towards a ceasefire, and that happened right at the very, very end of 2017, and that has largely held, I'm pleased to say. And that conflict came down significantly, and today it's continued on.
But not completely out of the woods in terms of the threat to civilians and the ongoing instability.
No, that's right. And I mean, look, over the last 4 years from that point, there has been a peace agreement that was reached finally in 2018. And then in 2020, last year, finally we had a transitional government, and Dr. Riek Machar came in as the first vice president to join in one government. So it was real progress over that period. But there has been ongoing intercommunal violence at a lower level that's gone on, and sometimes it's been stoked and continued on by some of the elites in Juba, and that's what we're focused on at the moment. Is the mission is certainly as our peacekeeping forces getting out there and trying to see if we can stabilize the situation a bit better.
You know, I mean, how have you navigated this incredibly complex political world in the world's youngest nation, where former brothers in arms became bitter enemies, leading military forces that, let's face it, as you said, have committed so many atrocities against their own people?
Look, it's one of those things. I think for the UN, we always had two main roles in South Sudan. One was to help build that durable peace that the country needed, and that was a lot of political negotiations, sitting down, talking. But, you know, working alongside IGAD and the African Union, who were really spearheading the way forward, and we were helping to come in behind and support them. That was the one big issue area that we had to work on. The other area was the protection of civilians, and that was means our peacekeepers getting out into the remote areas where fighting was ongoing, being a presence that could help stabilize things, calm things down, so that we could bring people together and do the negotiations and the reconciliation process that needed to go on. Two of those things went sort of hand in hand. And the more that you have durable peace, the less you need to do protection of civilians. And the less peace you have, the more that you protected civilians. So that was the kind of that seesaw, if you like, of those two roles was what continued right throughout my 4 and a bit years that I've been there.
What are the key changes that you made, and what kind of a difference do you feel that you've made? What would you like your legacy to be then?
That's a big question. I think a lot of the time what we were trying to do was just make sure things that we did stayed in place and we were able to move forward. And so, you know, like I have some, you know, to have some good memories when they signed the peace agreement finally in Addis. The UN was there to add its signature, to add my signature on behalf of the UN. That was one thing, having that peace agreement in 2018. But then the next big challenge was, how do we consolidate that on the ground? Because this is not like one front line. There's a multiple series of front lines where there's different groups fighting each other in different places. And one of the things that the UN did was to bring together those groups into one place. And a lot of our team brought those people together. But I remember very vividly sitting under trees with, you know, the opposition that came in with their guns and their weapons, and the government that came in with their guns and their weapons, and they sat down for the first time confronting each other after this peace agreement was signed to work out how they were going to come together. And, you know, in Wau, where there was a group there, that the two sides came together, and the senior general from the government side pointed his finger at his opposite number across the table and said, you know, for the last 3 years I've tried to kill you. And he said, and you've tried to kill me. And here we are, we're sitting together talking about how we can work together and carry on peace for the sake of South Sudan. And, you know, it's those moments, I think, you know, we work together in so many different ways to bring things together, but it's those moments where it just goes, yes, we've done something here. We've made a difference that we hope will be lasting, and these people are, you know, these people have engaged and got on with it.
You've obviously met some incredible people. Is there one particular sort of vignette, one story that sticks in your mind, just a regular conversation that really stuck with you?
One in particular. You know, I think a lot of the time, you know, talking to women, and I remember many
times...
Real brains
of the operation.
Yeah, well, it's true. It's absolutely true. You know, you sit in these meetings and the men often will jump up and talk about what's happening, and they'll talk politics. You know, React Mashadas and, you know, whatever. And then a woman will jump up and say, my children, they haven't had a chance to go to school. And my son was taken captured and taken into the armed forces. And now I'm left without my son. And it just humbles you. It brings you down to this very basic level, because while the men are talking politics, this is a woman who's feeling the pain of what's happening to her family and her children, and how to provide for that. And that's the motivation. That when you hear those stories, you go, you know, we really have a role to play here, and we really need to do it. And maybe we need to listen to the women much more than we listen to the men, because they're the ones who feel it, and particularly in South Sudan, they're the ones who. You know, who are the ones being raped, or the ones who have to go out to dangerous areas and collect firewood and bring it back. You know, it's a tough role for them. We were talking just today with people about, you know, we have a huge footprint. We've got 20,000 troops there, and we've put in two big solar farms to generate electricity rather than shipping in massive amounts of diesel. And I thought of it after, you know, 2 or 3 years of us doing this and seeing what we can do. And I thought, you know, we need to be planning for our legacy. And one of the legacies that we can leave behind is, yes, we can put in solar farms to help us power our own operations. But those can be done, those can be connected to the local town's hospital or the government buildings or the local school or whatever. So that when we leave, we hand over something, and it's thinking beyond, because in my job, there's always something that'll come through your door. I mean, there's a crisis comes through my door every couple of hours, or mini or maxi crisis or whatever, but something will happen. And so it's being able to give yourself the space to think a little more strategically about where we're going to be, what we're going to do, how we're going to behave as the UN, how are we going to disengage, but also what's the legacy we're going to leave behind. Peace is fantastic and stability is great, but there's other things that we can be doing because we're a $1 billion organization. We can be contributing more. So I guess that my regret is not thinking that through in a way that perhaps, you know, I could have done when I first joined the job.
I heard you on our sister show, Awake at Night, talking about the importance of roads. It seems that it's the mundane stuff that really is a long way from the kind of conventional front lines of Blue Helmets action that maybe is the most enduring.
Yeah, I'm pleased you brought it up, because we have seven peacekeeping companies, which are, you know, a couple of hundred people, mainly men, because they're soldiers or whatever, but they're rehabilitating the roads. Now, if somebody had said to me when I started the job, if you build roads, they're great for peace, I would have said, well, I think the connection is pretty tenuous. But actually, it's not. And where we've built roads and where roads have gone in, communities have communicated with each other and tension levels have come down. But more importantly, I think I've given this example before, but I mean, between the towns of Bor, which is mainly a Dinka town, and Pibor, which is mainly a Mule town, the Mule ethnic group, there was tensions between those two groups. We put the road in, well, before we put the road in, In PIBOR, if you'd gone into the market in PIBOR, you would have found virtually nothing, and what was there was horrendously expensive. We put the road in, and suddenly goods were travelling into PIBOR, and suddenly people were able to get pots and pans and shovels and spades and mattresses and sheets and clothes and everything else that people needed that were so amazingly expensive before. But for the mule who were cattle keepers, they started taking their cattle through to Boer because the prices were better. And when the prices were better, so everybody was benefiting. And as a result of that, tensions went down because there was communications, there were links, and there was real, there was a real economic dividend from it. So we've done a lot of roads. When this year we will have finished 3,500 kilometres of rehabilitating roads for things to move. And that's, I don't know what the country would be like without those roads, to be honest with you. It's sort of unimaginable in a way. I mean, I don't think that people will be able to move.
So at the end of 4 years, what will you take away with you back home to a quieter life, I hope, in New Zealand, when you reflect on the state of UN peacekeeping overall? And do you think we'll be able to tempt you back into service after a well-deserved rest?
Look, I think I've had an extraordinary privileged role in the way that you have this responsibility, but also this ability to make real change. And you ask about regret. Sometimes I wish I'd been able to change more and move things faster and get things moving a bit more. But I mean, overall, I look back and I think South Sudan went through a really positive change in those last 4 years, and we've been part of it, and we've helped it, and we've bolstered it, and we've helped move it on. And so when I look back on this 4 years, I think, it's a better place than when I found it, and the mission's in a better state than when I found it as well. And that converts into people's lives being better and less deaths. And I mean, you can never calculate it, of course, but it means that with this huge team helped to really make some change. So I've had a terrific time, work with some amazing people, South Sudanese who are unbelievably tough, resilient, and with a terrific sense of humour. They were able to smile and laugh and joke about their plight, and you think, I don't think I could do that. I mean, I really can't. And then, of course, the people that I work with within the mission and the UN agencies and the humanitarians that are great, great people to be. So I'm going to really miss them and going on. And never say never. I'll see what happens. I've got a few things I'd like to do. So once I've down tools for a little while, and I want to do a bit of writing, and there's some people I want to connect with, and then after that, who knows?